All right.
Okay.
Thank you, John Michelle. We're going to now move into our Q&A portion of the event. We have about 35 people in the room. Feel free to just raise your hand, and we'll take a question. We also have about 75 people online with us. We'll take a question from online, a couple of questions from online as well.
Okay.
And we have about 20, 25 minutes. So let's go ahead and start back here. I'm going to ask if you can say your name and your organization before asking your question. We really appreciate it. Thanks.
Hi, thank you. That was excellent. My name is Dan Silverstein. I'm a private sector and capital markets advisor in agricultural development. I have two questions. One relates to the viability of the local market. The assumption has to be, if they're going to sell in, that the market is substantial enough to absorb all of the harvest ex the warehouse product. So if you could address that, please. And the second is, how do you provide risk insurance to such a small sample of small growers? I'm not a risk insurance expert, but it seems like it defies everything that I thought I knew about diversifying risk over a region and climate and that kind of thing. So if you could address that, I'd appreciate that also. Thanks.
Turning to the market size, in the case of rice, Senegal actually imports like 800,000 tons of white rice. So, I mean, you've got a deep market once you are competitive. The problem has been to date that the quality was not there and the milling yields were very low, like below 60%, like 55 or things like that. So, of course, you know, they came up with very high costs and, you know, the mills didn't have a coordinated supply chain and we're not able to provide rice on a continuing basis to cities. And once again, you know, the whole milling the production capacity was based on a one crop cycle. So, you know, the whole supply chain did not work. It did work very well on a proximity basis. I mean, the regions where the rice is produced are self-sufficient and they do not consume imported rice. So there's actually a deep local market. Urbanization for corn is actually pulling the market, the grain market, strongly. I mean, the millers in Dakar who are providing poultry feed, you know, for a growing poultry market and egg market in Dakar are only part of the element, because you've got regional towns that are growing very fast and are actually the ones pulling the corn from those areas. But yes, there is the risk of overproduction, and that's where the whole stockpiling part is important. You know, we have to move away from just-in-time grain distribution. You want to have mechanisms to get the grain out of the backyards and out of, you know, schoolyards and things like that, and get them into decent warehousing where the marketing can be done in an orderly way, maintaining the grain quality and maintaining the productivity of the milling operations. But once that is done, there's actually, you know, a fairly very robust market. What's great also about the storage part and these collateral storage operations is that they operate as some kind of, we call it like vase communicant. It's like a siphon, you know. It shows you when the market is overloading, you know, and you have a way of capturing this overload that enables you to regulate, enable farmers to adjust. So if you do it in that kind of way, there's actually a very strong, you know, a smoothing mechanism. One thing I was worried about was what's going to happen with, you know, the U.S.'s recent bumper harvest of corn. You know, if you look at the, you know, Chicago Board of Trade, you know, the price for corn, like, was halved. I mean, it used to be a while back at $8 a bushel, and it reached that level. Now it's at, what, 370 or something like that. Yeah, it's not very high. Yet in Senegal, the price is actually stable. Farmers, you know, didn't have to suffer such a big price dips and were able also to increase their yields and are able to make their payments and actually are very bullish about it. Because that was the thing I was worried about. I was thinking, you know, when the grain price crashed, this is going to go all over the place. And no, it hasn't happened. And even now, you know, India is actually placing rice at a very low price. And, you know, the milling rates have gone up. Now the milling rates in the Senegal River Valley are reaching 65. And some of those, you know, networks and firms are really improving their quality control and developing sliding scale pricing mechanisms and are going slowly toward what they say 70. If they get 65, 66 on a continuous basis, it'll be good enough. So yes, there, you know, the market rationale is there, but yes, there is this optimization of the supply chain that's very, very important. Risk management, yes. Insurance is still at the nascent stage, but it's rain index insurance. And right now, and in the Saloum part, in the maize zone, we have supported the meteo agency to set up automated rain gauges in catchment areas that cover about 5 kilometers. And so there is like this systematic collection that is set up, and farmers subscribe to the rain index insurance to cover their input loans. And the system is managed and reassured with Swiss Re. It's a system that's financed with them. In the Senegal River Valley, in the Saloum, number of farmers insured right now, in maize, 2,000, you've got a few thousand from the peanut sector, a potential of 15, 20,000 farmers and loans covered. So, you know, there is a certain critical mass. In the Senegal River Valley, you're talking about, you know, input loans for a value of nearly, a yearly value of nearly $7, $8 million, 15,000 farmers covered. So, you know, you have a certain population. It's not small, and it's also cash-based. You know, this is not the other part, like the work-for-insurance kind of system. These farmers pay their insurance premiums, you know, and actually they have to pay it before they access the loan. So actually, you know, we've seen it this year. They take their own money, pay the insurance, make sure that they have their insurance coverage that is, you know, adapted to the amount that they want to plant as part of their loan application, and that's a way of securing the loan without having a buyer contract, and that provides reasonable insurance to the banks. So yes, you know, it is building up steam, and as the commercial market develops, then it should be working. Okay, yeah.
Let's go ahead and maybe take one question from the webinar, and okay, then we'll go back and we'll get the person in the room.
So I have a couple people asking about gender and your work. And so Christian from Freedom from Hunger asked, did PCE do anything to address gender bias issues? And Yindra asked if are female farmers treated as the same as their male counterparts? And if not, what are steps being taken to create an equal environment?
Yes, and well, you see it here on the screen. You have Nimna Diaité, who's the president of FEPROMAS, actually welcoming within FEPROMAS women who were working in millet and other sectors and who wanted to join the organization to be part of it and access those loans and be able to access those inputs to increase their yield. So yes, there is a gender bias, especially for cash crops, cereal cash crops. And in the maize sector, for example, only 15% of the farmers are women because they don't necessarily have access to the land that is used to do that. So, but as you see, you know, by focusing and getting women involved in it and opening up to them, and they actually, you know, can join the bandwagon. But to the biggest challenge, and yes, it is going to be a challenge, if we really, really want to bring the women population aboard, it's to work in those crops where they are present, and that's mainly rain-fed rice. And that was the supply system I was talking about, really working with women who work on food self-sufficiency crops and help them access inputs so that they can build a marketable surplus. That's one aspect. And the other part is working with women groups who are working in those, food security crops and help them develop a catch crop activity. To do that, you have to work with groups that are focused on that, women-owned groups, and that's what we're doing. Right now in the Casamance, the female population we are working with to bring in those technologies represents like 60% of the beneficiary base in the rain-fed rice sector. And yes, the issue there is to get these women who are very, very risk-averse to take that step of taking a cash position on their crop to get that yield bump. And that's a very, very gradual process. We don't want to speed it up and, you know, accelerate it, because, you know, you can end up with very, very counterproductive elements. Right now, we're working with these women groups to get them involved in certified seed production, which is an immediate and high-value crop that they can actually, you know, control and master, and that they can actually market in their immediate proximity. Gradually, you know, the best seed farmers are actually moving on to higher value cash crops. But it has to be a very progressive process. You don't want to pump steroids into that. It's not a good idea. But you're right. It takes very deliberate approaches and a very particular scaling strategy.
All right. We'll take one in the room and then go back to webinar.
My name is Peter White, and I work as an independent consultant for a number of USAID projects, including the West African Trade Hub, which today is the Trade Hub Network, as well as with Next, or formerly with Next, in Nigeria. I think the approach that you've taken, Jean-Michel, is really interesting, looking at the input side and input to farmers. And you also mentioned the importance of input to millers, and the fact that they need to maintain months of inventory. Could you comment a bit on the financing of millers and how that is working, and if that is increasingly being taken up by the commercial banks? Just a point of clarification. You mentioned that, if I understood correctly, that loans were guaranteed by the government. To what extent are they guaranteed by the government? And what impact does this have on creating a credit culture within the country? And I wasn't going to mention this, but it raised also an interesting point about this bumper crop of corn in the States at a time when West Africa is trying to promote internal production. How will Senegal sort of deal with this price competitiveness and availability of corn coming in from North America?
Okay, concerning the stockpiling mechanism, as you say, you know, the big issue is getting the millers to take a position on 6 months' worth of supply. And so the way that it is being done is by working with warehouses, okay, that are available in the area. And there was an initial set of warehouses that had been built a few years back that were available, but were used as like community level storages to do local selling. It was just to reconfigure existing warehouses and turning them into public storage points, okay, that are managed by the bank and the farmers and the millers. And so turning those warehouses into these kind of bonded warehouse mechanisms, which means that so the loans are placed there. It's like a warehouse receipt system, but where the farmers, I mean, don't go. Every farmer is not going away with his own little receipt to do his own little speculation. That's an interesting aspect. What we see is that farmers are not really interested in keeping their certificate and playing around with it, they're interested in offloading the rice and then getting inputs to do another run. Okay. And getting it off at, you know, a set price, a competitive, you know, a price that makes sense for them. So yes, it's a warehouse receipt system, but where the whole ownership is transferred. Okay. Now that has its limitations, because it's limited by the number of warehouses you have available. Okay. But yet that has spurred investments by the government in public warehousing. There's actually some private firms and millers who have invested in warehousing for their own needs. What's also interesting is that this system is actually backed. The loans they get to procure this stockpiled rice is actually offset also by credit mechanisms that are backed by client orders. I mean, by wholesalers. Like wholesalers reserve stock, okay, and based on those like promissory notes and, you know, even prepayments, this actually secures the Miller's collateral position. So it's really, you have this like back-to-back financing system that goes right to the market that actually collateralizes the paddy rice. It's not very different from rice imports, you know? And that was actually the guiding principle when we designed that. We said the valley was at a disadvantage with rice imports because a rice importer can bring in 20,000 tons of rice in a bonded warehouse in Dakar, you know, with a letter of credit and just put on the table barely 5% of the value of the whole thing. The rice itself was the collateral and actually finances the whole thing. In the old, you know, and formerly in the valley, if you wanted to buy 20,000 tons of paddy rice, you had to guarantee it against your equity. Paddy rice was not collateral. So that was a big breakthrough, turning paddy rice, unmilled rice, into collateral. For that, you had to make sure that it had proper quality. But once you do that, a miller, just with 5% of the value, can put down basic collateral and be able to stockpile, the same way that rice importers don't need as much, you know, cap equity to be able to stockpile important. So at what point you were putting imports and local production, you know, at par in terms of, you know, financing mechanism. Okay. You were talking about, what did you ask?
The credit culture and the guarantee by the...
Yeah, well, you know, it's more a... It's not really specific loan guarantees. I mean, it's really the government has this, it's really the Ag Bank, and the government like protects the bank against, you know, important loan defaults and things like that. But farmers don't consider that they, you know, their loan are backed by an actionable guarantee mechanism. Actually, what I was saying about, you know, the bank doesn't hesitate to kick farmers off the roster and really is actually very rigid about bringing them back into the system. And so you have a lot of farmers who are actually stranded out there and actually have to go and resort to, you know, more informal mechanisms that are very detrimental to them. Okay.
So we have a question on the webinar.
Yeah, we have several questions from the webinar, but I'm going to pick one. Robert Navin asks, what did PCE do to make sure that middlemen don't capture gains from increases in production, and what works in terms of strengthening farmer associations?
What did she say?
To make sure that middlemen don't capture gains from increases in production.
You know, like I said, you know, middleman. You know, what's a middleman? You know, a middleman is, or a middle woman, there are lots of middle women out there too, are just people who annoy very large firms who try to control their smallholder base. I mean, that's the whole side selling thing. If I put myself in the smallholder's shoes, a middleman is just a maize buyer, is just a rice buyer for me, as long as he pays me. And the formal market is very often the one who actually takes my grain and doesn't pay me. So for me, the middleman is actually a real market. A cash market. I mean, when I was asking them, now, why are you selling to those middlemen? He says, they're not middlemen, they're paying quite well. Yeah, but you got this order with this industrial firm. So, oh, come on, he's in Dakar. I mean, yeah, I'll give him 500 tons. It's all right, just for good measure. And who knows, maybe I'll need it one day. But we are selling our grain rice, you know, well. We will reimburse our loans. And they actually did, you know. I said, Nimna, what can I say? You know, sell to the middlemen. The middlemen are just local traders very often. And actually, the local traders were actually very happy to buy high-quality grain. Like they could actually sell to those other middlemen, which are the informal poultry producers that are working in all those site towns and are not buying the Argentine chicken feed, you know, Argentine corn-made chicken feed, and doing all these weird things, you know, but feeding a whole nation, you know. So, you know, middlemen, as long as they pay a decent price on time and are great. The only problem, as I was saying, is that when you get kicked out of the formal lending system and then you get a middleman lending money to you, Now, the middle man or the middle woman then changes name. They become loan sharks. Now, I agree to that. You don't want to get involved with loan sharks to finance your inputs. Okay, I agree with that. But a middleman who comes in with cold hard cash, good price, got a good product, pays you right there on the spot, go for it. Go for it.
Okay, we have about 10 more minutes, so we'll take another question in the room. Just for anyone who has to leave, either via webinar or in person, the post-event resources will be posted on Microlinks in about a week, and that includes a recording of this session. So we'll take a question in the room.
Hi there, I'm Sarah Cozen from Apt Associates. Thank you, Jean-Michel. That was a great presentation. You'd mentioned in the beginning that currently in Podor and Matam were pre-industrial. I was wondering if you could comment on the unique challenges of kind of bringing them up to the level that you see in Dagana.
Yeah. Well, that's it. Pre-industrial means, in terms of irrigated rice, is farmers who are like settlers, who are there, and their mindset was, you know, hey, you know, as long as I can farm for my own production, I'm okay. And usually the parcels are designed for that. The land attribution has been designed for that. So they get actually smaller plots, not much smaller, but smaller enough. Like they'll get, you know, 3/4 of a hectare, you know, very few will get 1, 1.5. And that makes a big difference, okay? Especially if you farm only one cycle, because then you don't have that much surplus available. Which means actually, you know, we did a study on poverty levels in the valley, you know, and really it was a random sample of the whole thing. And we used statistical analysis to see if there were like clusters. And we found that there were 3 clusters. The ones that were in commercial farming in the Delta, very different income profile, more, let's say, real little businesses. And then Group B were the Podor people. Were actually not bad off. You know, they were like milling along. I mean, they were producing rice, decent yields, feeding their family, a little bit to sell around. They were okay, in a way. The people less well off were actually the women in the Delta that were like completely marginalized from the commercial production. And that we actually, you know, we're talking about focusing on women. Then we actually had very specific programs for those women who were farming on marginal lands, but organizing local village level marketing of, you know, locally grown rice. And so they were like completely outside of the extension system. And yes, we focused on those women so that they also had access to certified seed, work with microcredit institutions, not necessarily the National Rural Bank, to set up their own systems, mirroring a bit the systems that are here. And so, yes, you know, they're like different populations. But Podor, if these farmers are able to double crop, that's the big deal. Okay, and that's what MCC wants to do. You know, the MCC has made investments there. And one of their objectives is to get these Podor farmers to do the double cropping. Because, you know, with the yields they're getting, 6-7 tons, small farmers on 1 hectare that does a double crop, I'm sorry, even on 0.5 hectare, he get pretty impressive windfall. And then he gets into the cash crop business, and you know, there are millers in the area, you know, who can start developing an industry. And so that's our main focus right now, is to get them to develop, you know, the yield part, understanding the quality aspects also, you know, that are very important to get your millers to be competitive, and then working on the financing to do that, you know, double cropping system, which is entirely driven by the logistics and financing cycle. Okay.
All right, and one more question from the webinar, and I think we'll have time for a little more in the room too.
We have a couple questions on related to quality in the system. Richard Tinsley from Colorado State University asks, how important is certified seed versus making certain that there are reasonable quality seeds in the market seed system? And Alou from Senegal asks, is there a third party to approve the quality in the system?
Okay, so the importance of certified seed, I mean, is paramount. I mean, it's clear that that is what has changed the game for rice in Senegal and for maize. There is a nuance there. First of all, this is not like agro-dealer distributed seed. What we're seeing is that, once again, we're talking about grassroots empowerment. It's actually getting the farmers themselves to acquire the skills to be certified, to produce certified. We're talking about women, you know, in Casamance, where these new varieties of rain-fed rice are coming in. We could have worked with agro dealers or businesses to do the seed multiplication and then sell those seeds to the women, developing market outlets, you know. But we didn't do that. We actually worked with the women groups so that they become certified seed producer, you know, and develop the skills to get it certified, get it controlled from the national certification body, okay, and then get it, you know, worked out. What's interesting is that what that system generates is actually a big production of quality seed, where the fields have been monitored, they've had access to quality foundation seed, but that they're not sending to the seed cleaning center. They're keeping it within the community because they don't want to truck it out and truck it back and bring it in a nice little yellow branded bag. They don't care. You know, they're saying, we know that this is good seed. There's been sensitization in the area. Our demonstration sites that we support are actually seed multiplication points at the same time. So they know that that seed will be quality. And then the following year, you know, the networks acquire the foundation seed and develop their own foundation seed production process. And their seed certified seed production process, part of it is actually marketed with agri-dealers to sell in other areas. So yes, certified seed production is very important, but once again, you have to push it right at the grassroots. Understand that, you know, part of it will be marketed by middlemen or by farmers themselves, you know, but it will be quality seeds, second, third, fourth generation, good enough, and generating that element and generating revenue at a local level. One thing that's important, though, is the fact, you know, that we're talking about open pollinated seed multiplication versus hybrids. We're seeing that the actual collection, you know, the penetration of hybrids, because of that, you know, cash management, you know, focus of farmers in a survival position, actually takes a long time to penetrate. Farmers actually prefer going for sturdy, open pollinated varieties for a certain time, and only farmers who have reached, you know, like Nimna, for example, at one point grew, and all these women, you know, went from one to two. Nimna now is pretty big, like she's at 15 or something like that, or 20. And yes, part of it is hybrid. Some of these women go to 2 hectares of maize, they'll add and take a chance on a hectare of hybrids. But they really hedge their bets. So, you know, thinking that, oh, we're going to solve it, we're just going to get all those hybrids out there and get the farmers to do hybrids, they're just not going to take it when you're going to tell them how much fertilizer they have to put in to get that additional bump. Okay? So that's a very important part. The final part is, like, who does the certification? Right now in Senegal, the government has a heavy hand in there, and it's actually not very clear. And it's very, however, what's very clear is that the government won't be able to hire all the seed controllers that are required to do that. So right now we're working on a private, you know, public-private kind of arrangement where you can have, you know, certified seed controllers that are being monitored by the government, but go there and for a fee perform the work on behalf of the government without having to be hired as civil servants. That's a challenge, but you know, the government has no choice because basically the government doesn't have that much money to spend on salaries. Yes?
Okay, and one in the room, we'll get you a microphone.
Yeah, hi, Jennifer Bremer of SICE. Thanks, it's a really interesting presentation. One thing that you didn't mention among, you know, I mean, it covered a lot, but was the issue of transport and transport costs, particularly the linkages to the urban markets. And I'm wondering, you know, what's happening with that and whether it, you know, whether maybe being cut off makes the local market stronger or whether they would be better off if there were better transport links to the urban areas.
Transport is actually very important. And before we talk about transport of the finished product to the towns and cities, let's talk about the pooling of, you know, raw material to the mills, you know. And that's where actually the financing system and the contractual model solved that. And that was the big windfall that actually enabled the mill to propose a much higher price, which actually freaked out the middleman. You know, we had middlemen coming in and telling us that the mill was cutting them off from their supply. And we said, well, our heart bleeds for you. That's not our problem. But why were they able to pay more? Because prior to that, they had to send their truck along and go and pick up rice here and there, coming in, say, oh, no, rice not there. Oh, I thought it was 5 tons, but hey, it was like 2 tons. You can go see my neighbor. And then at one point you get tired of it and just come back and say, well, I've got a half load, boss, and I did 5 times the trail. And that's actually what the mill came up to us saying, we're going crazy. We're spending a fortune, you know, on renting trucks. And it's just, and so the financing system here just takes all the grain and sticks it in a warehouse. And you got like 800 tons, 15 different points. The mill calls, you know, actually gets quotes from transport companies and tells them, okay, start by emptying that warehouse, then you do that one. And they're like at full load, you know, and you see those trucks coming in and out and in and out. Transport costs go way down. Quality goes way up.
Farmers are transporting to the collection
point. Yeah, and they're the best coordinators for that. You know, I mean, consolidation transport, farmers are great. I mean, they'll get the best and the cheapest way to do it for a premium. Everything, donkeys, carts, you know, whatever. They just focus on it, and it works. They do it very well. So, you know, you don't want to get involved in that. They do it very well, you know. Then, like you say, transport to the cities. Right now, what's happening is that the wholesalers are the ones coordinating the logistics, okay? Now, they're tradesmen. They know how to deal with it. The problem is, like, who does the job? In this case, the wholesalers are the best placed because they're based in Dakar. And for the rice mill, the big rice mill, what's happening is that you've got these trucks bringing, for example, wheat flour for the baguettes. You know, I mean, we are in Senegal. We do eat baguettes, you know. But there are wheat trucks getting in there. There are cement trucks, whatever trucks, platform trucks, going to the valley and coming back empty. And these traders all have their friends who are selling rebar wires and things like that. And they say, hey, tell me when you have a truck going. And when the truck goes, he says, okay, I'm chartering the backlog. And so you've got the trucks, you know, going and waiting at the mill and just sitting there. Of course, the mill calls the wholesaler and says, I'm not loading your truck until I see the money in my bank account. And the guy says, okay, it's in. That checks it on the internet because they, you know, this is like Senegal 2.0. And the guy checks in and says, yeah, I got, okay, it's in, okay, load the truck. They load the truck, goes back. So you see, that's the solution. It's really this like supply chain optimization based on communication, based on who does the right work, which actor is tasked to do, but you're optimizing capacity, and that's how you make it work, okay?
Fortunately, it's almost 10:30, so we thank you, Jean-Michel, again for giving a great presentation today, and we thank all of our in-person attendees and those who had joined us online.